Recovery efforts at the Surfside condo collapse site are winding down. COVID-19 cases are on the rise, a South Florida superintendent has resigned, and calls for U.S. intervention in Cuba are being made from Miami to Washington, D.C. This is the South Florida Roundup. I'm Wilkin Brutus, in for Tom Hudson. Nearly 1 month after the Champlain Towers South collapse, recovery workers have found nearly all of the unaccounted for. Plus, we'll have the latest information on the uptick of coronavirus cases in the region, and Palm Beach County School Superintendent has announced he's leaving his post. And finally, we'll have a conversation about the Cuban uprising and what lies ahead for the island nation. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Wilkin Brutus, in for Tom Hudson. Recovery efforts continue in Surfside after the partial collapse of the 12-story-plus penthouse Champlain Tower South building last month. But those efforts could end soon. The death toll is at 97. The Miami-Dade Police Department told WLRN yesterday that 93 victims have been identified so far. And then Florida COVID-19 cases are on the rise. Miami-Dade County reported 4,362 cases at the end of last week. This is despite 73% of residents having received at least one dose of the vaccine. You can share your thoughts about the ongoing pandemic by calling us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. We'll get to your calls and tweets in just a few minutes. First, we'll get an update on Surfside recovery efforts with the town's mayor, Charles Burkett. Thanks for joining us, Charles.
Good afternoon.
Nice to meet you. There have been dozens of people that have been recovered from the rubble. So far, how many people have been accounted for at what was once Champlain Tower South?
Again, we're going to get an update today at 4:30. I don't usually comment on those numbers. Out of respect for the families, we let the police department and the fire department make those initial reports to the family, and then we can talk about it.
And how many remain unaccounted for in that regard?
Again, that's a number that I don't usually get involved in until after the family's advised.
Right. Are state and federal agencies still on site helping with recovery, and for how long will they remain in Surfside?
Well, we have NIST here right now, and they are actively pursuing an investigation. They're on the site. They're taking samples. They're preserving evidence, and it is a criminal investigation right now that is ongoing, or civil at least. The state attorney is involved, so they're in charge of that.
Mayor Burkett, any new developments into what may have caused the collapse?
You know, we're looking very carefully at the sister building for clues. Our expert has called it a science lab because it's substantially the same building, built at the same time, probably with the same contractor, probably with identical plans, and probably with identical materials. So it's a very good opportunity for us to really go through that building above ground and below ground to try to understand exactly what happened, because right now nobody has any idea.
And was FEMA on site for search and rescue?
FEMA was on site very soon after the collapse. Search and rescue was on site that night, just hours or even minutes, I should say, after the collapse. I was out there with our town manager and our building official, and I know that they had dogs running very soon after we arrived.
And have those crews been dispelled?
No, there are two Florida task forces still engaged in search and recovery. And while it's become very, very difficult at this stage because most of the debris has been removed and we're sort of struggling with water in the that's coming up from the ground and basically covering up the remaining evidence. It's become difficult, but that aside, they still proceed forward.
Now, State Senator Jason Pizzo said he wants to create a score system for building structures. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that the Dade County mayor, our officials, everybody's agreed that the book is going to have to be rewritten once we understand why this building fell down. Because as I've said before, buildings in America just don't fall down. That's a third world phenomenon and something that we're not going to accept here in the United States. So once we understand why the building fell down, federal, state, and local officials will work together to get those rules rewritten so that this potentially never, never happens again.
Mayor Burkett, many victims are named. There are various stories about the people who lost their lives, and you've spoken to so many throughout the process. Is there any particular story that has stood out for you?
Well, listen, I don't know if you're aware of the story about the 12-year-old girl that I came across days after the collapse, late at night when I was doing my last pass of the site. I came across a 12-year-old girl who was sitting by herself and looking at her cell phone. And I walked up to her and asked her what she was doing, and she told me she was praying. She was praying because her father was in the rubble just feet away from where she was sitting and praying. And it struck me so dramatically that I had to sort of kneel down and just be with her for a while to try to help her through that, because it was really moving. It was really something that I can't describe. And I'll tell you what, after I walked away from her telling her that she could call me anytime she needed anything, I still felt as though I hadn't done enough. And the next day I was able to find her and go see her and give her more information and become friends with her. And she and I have been talking ever since. I think it's a terrible bit of irony that her father is, I believe, still unidentified in this tragedy. So it's really been painful, especially for her. But she is the bravest, most beautiful little 12-year-old girl I've ever met. Every time I see her, she's strong, and she's hopeful. And I really, other than to support her and be with her, it's hard to know what to do in a situation like this.
Local officials are beginning to discuss what will stand in place of the collapsed site in Surfside to honor those victims. What possibilities have been discussed so far?
Well, many. The families were told recently that the site is potentially going to be sold, and that came as a real bolt out of the blue to them, because I don't think they or we were emotionally prepared for something like that to happen so soon. The families are now kind of pushing back on that notion, and I think the judge has done a very good job in listening, and I believe that he is taking into account their desires, because a lot of those families, want to see some sort of memorial on site because they have loved ones that have been lost there, but they also love Surfside, and they love their homes, and they loved where they live, and they would like to come back and live there. So, you know, and that's a tragedy on top of a tragedy, because this building fell down and they've been put out of their homes. Now they're being told they can never come back. And that's just really striking at the heart of many of these victims.
And to your point, it's a tragedy on top of a tragedy. And so folks are focused on time at this point. What is the timeline looking like for answers into the investigations into the cause of the collapse?
I'll tell you, I sat in a meeting last night for the first time with the receiver, who has been put in charge of sort of arranging the affairs and logistics with respect to the building. And I've got to tell you, it was disturbing to me because, you know, there are lots and lots of lawyers and lots of conversations being had, conversations that these families really don't understand or grasp, especially at this early time. And to them, it seems like it's out of their hands and out of their control, and that's creating fear and anxiety. But more so, it's the not being able to be in control and feel like they have a say into what is going on is really hurting. So I stood up at that meeting and said that I don't agree with the pace of what is happening. I don't agree that the determination should be made to sell the property or even move in the direction of selling the property, because that's a very final solution to an issue that's extremely fluid at this moment.
Right, and the issue will certainly remain fluid for a few months now. Thank you so much for joining us, Mayor Burkett.
My pleasure.
Okay, I'm Wilkin Brutus in for Tom Hudson. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We've had a series of major breaking news in the past few months, but we're still in a pandemic. And experts throughout South Florida say we are now battling highly infectious variants of COVID-19, specifically the Delta variant. Are you still taking measures to prevent the spread of the virus? Did you retire your face mask after getting vaccinated? What are your thoughts on the ongoing pandemic? Call us now, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Joining us now is Dr. Arlene Marty, an infectious disease expert with Florida International University. Dr. Arlene, how are you? Dr. Marty?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes,
hello,
I can hear you now.
Hello, this is Dr. Marty. Yes.
I'm glad all is well. Let's start with just a basic update here, Dr. Marty. Are you seeing COVID-19 cases rise across South Florida, and are they linked to that Delta variant?
So those are actually two separate questions. Are we seeing a rise in cases? Absolutely. Just over the last 7 days, there's been a rise of almost 50% in cases, and there's increase in positivity overall. Increase in hospitalization has been dramatic, with a 63.45% change upward, more use of beds overall, and more use of ICUs as well. There's unquestionably many more cases, and it's due to a variety of reasons, primarily because there are unvaccinated people, and they are the ones who are occupying the overwhelming majority of the beds and the overwhelming majority of the cases, behaving as if the what the CDC said that vaccinated people could do applied to them, and it does not. It really does not. They are still at very high risk. And yes, the Delta variant is another component that we know is at over 50% in the nation right now in terms of the statistical average of what's going on in the variants. We've dropped the percent of Alpha, which was previously the dominant form in the United States. And now it's mostly Delta that we're seeing. But even so, we know that people who are vaccinated have a much lower risk of having severe disease or death, even when they're exposed to the Delta. But it's not zero. And I think it's very important that people need to continue to remember that we need to have layers of protection, and we need to have situational awareness.
What other variants of the virus are being found in South Florida?
Oh, there's a huge list of different variants that we find in South Florida. A growing percentage of our cases are also the Gamma variant, which is what we used to call the P1 or variant from Brazil. We still see the Alpha variant, and we still see ordinary, if you will, the original form. And sporadically, we see some of the variants that formed in that were originally identified in California and the four corners of the United States.
Now, Dr. Marty, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have informed the public about COVID-19 vaccine breakthrough cases that they are expected. Is it still rare, or do you see a trend of fully vaccinated people getting COVID-19?
So we are seeing more individuals who are fully vaccinated who have who are testing positive. And also a very small percentage who are also being symptomatic, and much more than we were seeing before when we first gave out the vaccines. And there's several reasons behind that. Number one, and I think it's important that the listeners understand, the type of immunity that you're forming with the vaccine is the best you're going to get. And you do have long-lasting good memory cells of both the B and T cell type that you need. However, the vaccines that we received were specifically targeting the exact shape and of the spike of the original virus. And some of these mutants, particularly the Delta variant and the South African variant, are a little harder for those antibodies to function against. And so that's brought the efficacy a little bit down. And that's why you've heard of studies maybe from Israel and from Scotland showing a significantly decreased efficacy, even of these phenomenal vaccines that we have, in terms of preventing any symptoms. But what it's definitely preventing is the worst thing, which is it's preventing long COVID. And that's now, there's a series of studies showing that. And that's very important because that is one of the worst complications that we're seeing in people who have had COVID and in people who even had no symptoms when they were initially infected. And then 19% of them somewhere down the road develop some of these long COVID symptoms if they were naturally infected. So the vaccine protects against long COVID. It protects against severe cases and death. So
And just to clarify, did you say 50% increase of cases in Florida?
The numbers of cases have risen over the last 7 days by 49.18%. So I said approaching 50%.
Okay. As of July 6th, out of the more than 157 million people vaccinated around the country, just over 5,000 people experienced vaccine breakthrough infection. Are the variants causing breakthrough cases?
So what we know is that the Alpha variant was about 50% more contagious, if you will, than the original variant. And this Delta, and there's actually three flavors of the Delta variant, but these Delta variants are 50 to 60% more contagious than the Alpha one. So it's much, much more contagious. What does that mean? That means that first of all, the reproductive number for somebody who's who is not vaccinated is now significantly higher when with the transmission. So we're seeing reproductive numbers being estimated at about 6, which is ridiculously high. The amount of virus that needs to get into your body for that virus to be able to colonate some of your cells and reproduce is less because it's that much more potent. So absolutely, the Delta variant of the SARS-2 virus is contributing significantly to cases of breakthrough.
Dr. Marty, that's extremely, extremely informative. Please stay with us. We've got John in Hollywood who got vaccinated, ditched his mask, and then got COVID. Hello, John. Are you on?
Hi. Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hey, I can hear you well.
Hi. So, yes, unfortunately, I'm one of those breakthrough patients that you were talking about. I got vaccinated on the very first day that I was able to get vaccinated. I then ditched my mask, figuring that I had the highest form of antibodies I could possibly get. And then before I was about to fly, I needed to take a PCR test. I was flying to Israel, and they required PCRs before anyone flies to Israel. I then found out I was positive. A day later, I lost my sense of taste. I didn't have any other symptoms, but I actually did have one other question for the doctor, if I may. I wanted to know, now that I have both been vaccinated and contracted COVID, do you believe it's still a good idea to continue wearing masks?
Dr. Marty?
Thank you, John. So I'm very sorry that that happened to you. I'm glad that the only symptom you had was the loss of sense of taste, and I hope that you do not experience any long COVID. I doubt that you will because you were vaccinated. May I ask which vaccine you received and when exactly?
Yes, I received the Pfizer vaccine back in the very end of March.
Okay. So I have also seen some other patients of my own that also received either Pfizer or J&J that have similar stories to yours. The reality is the type of immunity that you get from the wild virus is not of the same quality. For whatever reason, people who get the wild virus, whichever flavor of it you get, the B cells that are made are not made in the educational centers of our immune system. And they're not made in what's called the germinal centers. And so they're not long lasting. So they'll give you, certainly help you for a while, but they won't last as long as the ones that you got from your Pfizer. The reality remains that we have to layer our protections. And yes, it is the absolute best single way of protecting ourselves, but every form of protection, like the Swiss cheese model shows us, has holes. And so as you layer your protection in different settings, you're going to decrease your overall risk. I can't say that you won't get it again, and I can't say that you might not need a booster at some time. But I will tell you, John, that other individuals that are patients of mine that have had breakthrough, we have found an underlying reason why they had breakthrough. And so you might want to chit-chat with your physician and look into that.
John in Hollywood, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Marty, please stay with me. Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava told WLRN yesterday she is urging residents to return to mask wearing to curb the spread of the virus.
I'm recommending it for our county employees. And in general, yes, I'm recommending it, except with people that you know are safe. In your small family groups or those that you know have tested negative, that sort of a thing.
Dr. Marty, would you recommend people to resume mask wearing as they go about their daily lives?
So as when speaking to John, layering is always a good idea. So you have to have what I call situational awareness. Are you outside by yourself and you're vaccinated? Go ahead and take your mask off. For goodness sakes, you don't need it in that situation at all. But if you're going to be indoors in a crowded, poorly ventilated space where you don't know the vaccine status or the COVID positivity status of the people that are in that room, then you have to be aware that even if you're vaccinated, your particular ability to fight off a very large bolus of virus is diminished because, that's the problem is if you get a higher dose getting into your body per unit time, then even the protection that you have from the vaccine can be overwhelmed. So you want to not overwhelm your body at any given time so you don't end up with this high bolus of virus getting into your body so that it overwhelms your protection.
What will you be watching for in terms of cases and positivity rates of that virus?
So, first of all, we're very much focused on what's going on in our hospitals right now. Right now, we still have the staff that we need to manage the patients. But remember, our increase in number in Miami-Dade is 63.45% increase over the last week in terms of hospitalization. So if we keep on this trajectory, we may get back into a situation where we run out of supplies and we run out of staff, and that could have a very detrimental effect on every single one of us. So that's one of the key indicators that I'm looking at. And then we have to go back and think a little bit about the measures that we've removed and which of those we should go back to definitely using. I think Mayor Levine-Cava is correct that in the right settings, masking is a very good idea and really should be done because it adds that layer of protection that we need.
Dr. Arlene Marty, thanks for informing the public and thanks for joining us. Still to come, Palm Beach County Public School Superintendent announced that he would be stepping down from his position this week. You can share your thoughts and reactions to the announcement by calling 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I'm Wilkin Brutus. Tom Hudson is out this week. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. The school district of Palm Beach County Superintendent Donald Fenoy gave his 90-day notice to the school board this week. The announcement was a surprise to the school board chairman, Frank Barberi.
I received a call from Dr. Fenoy very early yesterday morning. As I have told the media, his decision was unexpected. I think everyone needs to recognize the huge challenges faced by a superintendent of a very large school district.
Now, the announcement comes after a tumultuous year for the district's first black superintendent. He clashed with the school board members over his response to the coronavirus pandemic. At a school board meeting this week, Fenoy gave a simple reason for his departure.
I look forward to continuing to serve in our community in other ways while also spending more quality time with my family.
School board members will now begin their search for a new superintendent. It'll be their fifth superintendent search to fill the position in 10 years. Does your child go to school in Palm Beach? Do you work for the district? Share your reaction to Fenoy's resignation by calling us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can share your thoughts with us on Twitter, too. We're at WLRN. To help us unpack the announcement and the moments leading up to it, WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman joins us now. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup, Jessica.
Thank you for having me. It's a joy to listen to you, Wilkin.
Thank you. Besides Fenoy's handling of the pandemic, what other major issues did he have to face during his tenure that forced his colleagues to question his leadership?
Well, as you mentioned, the superintendent did have some clashes with the school board and the teachers union. And I think it's important to consider the fact that during the 3 years he was superintendent or has been superintendent, he's dealt with just crisis after crisis. I think it would challenge any leader, especially someone who was new to his position, which he was. He had been a chief executive within the district earlier, but it was his first time becoming a superintendent. He'd sort of worked his way up through different administrative roles throughout his career. And so obviously you have the pandemic issues. You know, one of the big things related to that was handling how teachers returned to classrooms when we reopened schools last fall. I'll remind you that Florida is one of the few states that had schools pretty much open statewide throughout all of last school year. There are some schools, states and big school districts that did not reopen at all since the pandemic began. So that was obviously really difficult to manage. And one of the big problems that came out of that was teachers felt as if they were misled by Superintendent Fenoy, his administration, in terms of their ability to work remotely or get some permission to not have to come into the school if they had an underlying condition that might have put them at higher risk of a severe case of COVID-19. And that was something that the school board and the principals and the teachers really all criticized. But he's had to deal with a bunch of other stuff too. You know, he started a month after the Parkland school shooting in February 2018, when, you know, obviously Palm Beach County is just north of Broward, so it hits close to home. But, you know, either way, throughout the state of Florida, there were so many changes that came out of that in terms of how to handle policing in schools, how to handle mental health care in schools, how to handle, you know, hardening school buildings. So those were things that he faced as well. And there was a controversy over a principal who refused to acknowledge the Holocaust as a real historical event, and kind of some back and forth with appeals over his firing. He did end up eventually getting fired, but there was some criticism in the community about how the school district and then the superintendent handled that situation. And then more recently, you know, this was more of a school board thing that they brought up, not something that was necessarily a major priority of the superintendent's, but still he's the superintendent, he's in charge. So when any kind of controversy is going on, you know, he's going to be included in that. And in recent weeks, there has been a backlash from white parents in the school district over a new equity statement that in part said the school district was committed to dismantling structures rooted in quote white advantage, which some white parents took issue with, and the school district did end up taking those words out of the equity statement, which in turn received a backlash from, you know, proponents of racial justice.
Wow, Jessica, I mean, that is quite the roller
coaster. I know, and it's not
tenure.
Even everything. That's just like a handful of the things. So I would also like to mention that Superintendent Fanoy also had a really difficult time personally throughout this period. His wife's parents
and
died
one
of
second
COVID.
Jessica, let me interrupt you really quick just to reset.
Okay.
I'm Wilkin Brutus in for Tom Hudson. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're speaking with WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman about the resignation of the Palm Beach County School Superintendent. You can join the conversation by calling 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can tweet us at WLRN. Jessica, what's next for the school district? Will Fanoy remain in his position until October, or could he leave his post sooner?
The plan is for him to be in his position through October because his contract required a 3 months notice to the school board if he decided he wanted to leave. I think the school board could decide to allow him to leave sooner, but they have not said at this point that they intend to do that. And, you know, you can imagine that you wouldn't want the school district to be without a leader. So I think they're probably going to take all the time they can get to keep him in place while they figure out whether they're going to do a national search going forward, whether they're going to look for someone internal to take over. Either one is time consuming and a little bit difficult.
Last question. Palm Beach County Schools will reopen next month for the more than 170,000 students. How does Fanoy's resignation affect the reopening plans?
I don't know that it affects the plans, you know, as they stand in any specific way. But of course, when you have any kind of turnover in leadership, there's going to be, some growing pains, some struggles that come with that. So I think that's what we'll be looking to see. And, you know, if the school board is kind of busy dealing with figuring out how to replace him, you know, how that affects, what's going to happen with the school district and how that reopening goes, we'll just have to see. But, you know, as far as we're planning at the moment, you know, schools were open all last school year. Just shortly in the beginning of the school year, they weren't, but in Palm Beach County, they were open since September. So that was the vast majority of last school year. And then they plan to be open again, this fall. So it's going to be, I think, a difficult adjustment for any school district.
Jessica Bakeman, thank you so much for your time. That is quite the tenure for Mr. Fanoy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, thank you, Wilkin, for taking the time to chat with me about it.
Absolutely. Still to come, we'll be discussing the unprecedented public uprising in Cuba. Share your thoughts and comments with us by calling 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Wilkin Brutus. Tom Hudson is off this week. Thousands of people in Cuba took to the streets this week to protest a Communist Party that has been in power for over 60 decades. As videos of the protest spread like wildfire online, people in South Florida and across the state mobilized in solidarity with the Cuban people. The Cuban government cut off the internet in the country, prompting lawmakers like Republican Congressman Carlos Jimenez, who represents Florida's 26th congressional district, to urge the Biden administration to provide internet for the island nation.
Find the technologies, fund the technologies, put them to work
right
in Cuba so that the people of Cuba, my home country, can finally say, free at last, we are free at last.
What lies ahead in this uprising? Can the U.S. provide aid? Will it? Do you have ties to Cuba? What discussions have you been having about the protests? What would you like to see happen there? Share your thoughts with us. We're on Twitter. You can tweet your thoughts. We're on WLRN. Or you can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Joining us now is WLRN's Dana Rivero and Patrick Upman, CNN international correspondent and Havana bureau chief. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Patrick.
Thank you.
Hey, you're in Cuba. How are things on the ground right now, and how are you accessing the internet?
Well, accessing the internet has been a challenge. It is since really late Sunday, been essentially turned off or restricted, and right now, certain messaging apps like WhatsApp and other social media remain blocked. You know, it's important for people to realize that all the internet comes through a Cuban state company, so they can turn on the communications or they can turn them off, and that's what has happened this week. They've made it much, much harder for everybody to post, to have internet access. The Cuban government says that the United States is using the internet to attack Cuba by sharing all these sometimes really horrible videos that we've seen. And so it is restricted, although today it is somewhat better and we're actually able to speak. I was not able to use Zoom yesterday.
And what are you seeing on the ground right now?
So, you know, on Sunday, just to start there, you had one protest in a town in the next province over from us, which really started because people have been without power in the middle of summer in Cuba for about a week, and they got upset and they took to the streets. And what was different about this time, because this happens, and before you would hear about it, it's kind of an urban legend when one little town or a neighborhood got really upset and they went out and they confronted their local officials. But because of the way that Cubans are now connected and have been connected the last several years, people were able to live stream it and immediately share videos. And those videos and photos and live streams went all over the country. And amazingly, in the space of several hours, we had people taking the streets in towns and cities about across the entire island, which is something that has never happened before. Very quickly, there was a crackdown by the Cuban government, people being arrested in great numbers. People going out in the streets, police and just government supporters organized by the government to prevent these protests from taking place. The internet crackdown, which I already mentioned. And so for the moment, at least the Cuban government appears to have retaken control. But of course, this is a moment I don't think any Cubans on this island we'll ever forget, and a lot of people are wondering what comes next.
You say the government has retaken control right now. Many experts have said that demonstrations in Cuba were one of the largest in decades, maybe since Fidel Castro's revolution in the late 50s. Anti-government protests aren't allowed in Cuba. So what provoked this protest, and why do you think the people were brave enough to stand up against their government?
I think the conditions in Cuba over the last several years have really deteriorated. I've lived here for 9 years. You know, it's always been tough. If you're Cuban and don't have family sending you money regularly from abroad, or you're not one of the small percentage of people that has a job that pays a decent salary, the average person has a really tough life. And during the pandemic, the lines for food have just become beyond what anyone has ever remembered. There's less things that are in the stores because the government has to import so much. Cuba doesn't grow enough food to feed its own people. Now the government doesn't have the hard currency to import enough food. So conditions have really gotten tough. Of course, the U.S. cutting off remittances, that's impacted people. The fact that it's so hard to travel now with the pandemic means that family members can't bring in items. Cubans, the lucky who can travel, can't go and buy things and bring it back, sell them to other people. So there's just so much less. Life has gotten so much harder. And there's just a frustration that's palpable that you feel every day. And that frustration on Sunday and this week really boiled over in a way we've never seen before.
Patrick, looks like the protests within Cuba have brought some results. In a televised address, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel admitted to some of the shortcomings that played a role in the unrest. You know, the power outages, food and medicine shortages, for example. Are there other major, more structural factors that played a role in the unrest within Cuba?
I mean, I think, you know, the concession, as it's been called, that Miguel Díaz-Canel made, you know, it's something that people wanted for a long time. Cubans talk about the two blockades, which is the term the government uses for the embargo here, el bloqueo. And the second bloqueo, the second blockade, is the one the Cuban government puts on its own people. And one of those signs of the blockade is when you arrive here bringing medicine for your family, food for your family, gifts for your family. A lot of times Cubans have to pay high duties on those items. And that's always enraged people here, that why do they have to pay duties on goods they're just bringing in for their family that otherwise their family wouldn't have access to. So yes, they lifted the duties for the rest of this year. Right now, there's so few flights anywhere. It takes months to leave Cuba if you're even able to. So I don't see, at least during the pandemic, how this is going to have that much of an impact. Right now, it's more symbolic, but perhaps they will reopen flights and people will be able to bring in the goods that Cubans desperately need. Certainly, that concession's not enough to stop the anger and the frustration that led to the protests.
Let's talk about that double blockade. How much do U.S. sanctions affect Cuba's state-run economy?
According to the Cuban government, you know, this is the root of all of the problems in Cuba, that the U.S. sanctions, and if just those sanctions were lifted, this would be a prosperous country. And the reality is, so this is an island that has held on to a lot of the failed economic policies of the Soviet Union. It's probably one of the places that's changed the least in terms of economic planning since the fall of the Berlin Wall. You go out in the countryside and you see very little food production. You see people using oxen and cutting rice by hand, agricultural techniques that no one uses anymore in this century or the last. And a government that's depends too much on centralized planning and will not let people open the businesses that could really allow this country to flourish again. So it's both of the excuses you hear about Cuba's problems are somewhat true. U.S. sanctions have a big impact. There's no doubt about it. And they tend to hit the people on the bottom more, particularly now that remittances have been cut off. But the Cuban government needs to do more to reform their economy. And they've been too reluctant in the last few years. Every Cuban economist will tell you to do that. They're afraid of losing control. And that is one of the reasons the economy is in the state that it is.
Patrick, stay with me. There's so many different layers to this. Danny, how are Cuban Americans in Miami who have various political and ideological leanings responding to this very moment?
Pretty much across the board. I mean, it's there's a lot of hope for the first time in a very long time through the eyes of a lot of Cuban Americans that things could actually change on the island. You know, the government has had this basically blanket ban on anti-government protests. I mean, we've seen some very small ones pop up, as Patrick mentioned, in some towns. Every once in a while they would pop up, but really since people got access to 3G mobile internet 2 years ago, we've been seeing it happen more and more. And then just this last week, we saw it erupt across the island. So people here in the diaspora are looking at that and they're saying, wow, like this is a true awakening of what Cuba could be. And so, you know, there's a lot of emotions. I've talked to a lot of people that are, you know, out in the streets crying, you know, they want to help their families. They really do feel that a huge large scale change is right around the corner right now.
And Danny, it's hard to ignore the technological aspects of this story. The hashtag SOS Cuba is trending on social media. Has it helped Cubans in the diaspora communicate better and be a bit more informed about what's going on?
I would say absolutely. I mean, I was at a protest, yesterday, 2 days ago? And there's a lot of, you know, recent arrival Cubans that are very connected to things on the island. But the use of social media has also connected first and second generation Cuban Americans and a lot of younger Cuban Americans with things on the island. You know, they're seeing these images that maybe they've only heard their parents or their grandparents talk about what state repression looks like. Well, now they're following the hashtag. And they're seeing it with their own eyes, and it's there's not even words for it. It's state violence, you know. So it has connected both sides of the diaspora. You know, there's a common refrain where there's 11 million people on the island, and then there's 2 million in the diaspora. And there, some people look at both of them together as a true nation of 13 million. And what we're seeing is that some people here are feeling that they are a part of that 13 million, and social media is really helping connect those dots.
Now, so this is a huge dichotomy between connection and disconnection. There were reports of an internet blackout. How has that affected reporting, especially after reports of human rights abuses?
Right. Well, and I'm sure Patrick runs into this as well, but it's very hard in normal circumstances to sometimes verify some things that happen on the island, because even though internet has become a lot more widely available, it's not universally available. It does cost money, so a lot of it tends to be people that have connections to family in the U.S. or whatnot. But when you have, you know, what we saw over the last couple of days, where in some moments it was basically a blanket ban, I mean, it becomes almost impossible to communicate with people, to get firsthand accounts of things. And then, you know, on the other side, the government ministries, you know, that by default, their statements, you know, toe the line of the party that wants to maintain control. So you have to take everything that comes out of the, you know, so far they've acknowledged one death that happened in the protests. You know, that's what they say. But, you know, I don't believe that.
Right. And for folks looking from the outside in, I mean, there is a lot of complexity with this. There were reports of counter protesters as well. Danny, how would you describe the various political and ideological differences within Cuba? Do you often hear about these differences, these different ideological beliefs within the country?
Right. Well, I think, you know, there is a common thread. The common denominator with the Cuban opposition is opposition to the current system. You know, the communist dictatorship does not work, has not worked for a long time. There is pretty much universal acknowledgement on that. But, you know, Cuba is also a complex society. It has, there are socialists that do not like the communist government. So there's anti-government socialists, there's anarchists, there's, you know, punk rock bands, there's hip hop groups that, you know, and all their followings and subcultures. And, you know, it's a full, there's an image in a lot of people's heads about, like, you know, Cuba, salsa music, 1960s, like the culture and what Cuba is so much more complex than that. And that's all, you know, illustrated through the variety that you see in the opposition.
Right. And Patrick, last question for you. Do you believe the Cuban government has regained control? And if so, are there long-term impacts of this rare protest?
We'll be feeling the impacts of what happened this week in Cuba, and certainly in South Florida for years to come. I think it's a day that a week that everyone will remember, and has really changed the political landscape. It's important to remember here that you know, while these protests were violent, some people threw rocks, and the Cuban government, of course, is making it seem like their supporters got the worst of it. It's the Cuban government that has all the power here. People don't have guns. Right. Regular people don't have guns. And until the Cuban police and the Cuban military somehow someday decide to change side, the Cuban government will probably remain in control. But certainly the government officials that I've spoke to realize that this is a disastrous week for them. They cannot spin the kind of heavy-handed crackdown that it's taken place. And for me, you know, being out in those protests and seeing people for the first time, regular people just going up to Cuban police to their face and saying "Libertad, freedom, patria, vida," and chanting that they wanted liberty. And then you add up all the people who did that; it's thousands of people. I think that really shook the Cuban government. I don't think they really perhaps realized the level of anger that exists and people who have lost their fear and want a change. But again, in a country where the military and the police state are so powerful, I don't know how that leads to a greater change in this island. But certainly the government was as shaken this week as any other time that I can remember.
And Danny, the Cuban government blamed U.S. involvement and social media platforms for the demonstrations. And this has certainly sparked conversations surrounding U.S. foreign intervention. It's pros and cons. How is that conversation playing out in South Florida?
Well, you know, when you go to the rallies, there are a lot of chance of intervention. You know, a lot of people here want intervention. you know, and when you talk to people about the nitty-gritty about what that means, is that humanitarian intervention? Is that military intervention? It's kind of all of the above and not a lot of specifics. I mean, I think for the most part, what I've been hearing from Cuban Americans that are coming to the rallies and whatnot is that they want the U.S. government to do something. And, you know, we don't have a clear idea of what the Biden administration might be doing. You know, President Biden yesterday said they might make some kind of move to maybe bring better internet through the use of satellite technologies
Hey, Danny, we're running out of time. Sorry about that. Patrick and Danny, I want to thank you both for joining us.
Thanks,
thank
Wilkin.
You.
I'm Wilkin Brutus. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can tweet us at WLRN. That would do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alisa Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations and show's technical supervisor is Peter Mers. Richard Eves answers phones. I'm Wilkin Brutus. Thanks for calling and listening. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, bee removal specialist.
WLRN Public Media.